welcome to the Autoblog Podcast. I am Dan Roth, and joining me this week is Zachary Bowman.
Good evening, guys.
And the man, the myth, the legend, Jeff Ross.
Happy New Year.
Hooray.
Happy New Year.
The Autoblog Podcast is brought to you by TireRack.com, the leading online source for tires and so much more, including a large selection of winter tires, as well as aftermarket wheels, suspension, and brake components, and those items that make it easier to see, like windshield wipers and replacement lighting. So no matter what your vehicle, check them out at TireRack.com. And we will move on to the Autoblog Garage right away. And Jeff Ross, what are you driving?
I think you might want to skip me.
No. Come on now.
What you driving there?
The Chrysler 200 convertible with cloth.
Did you rent
How
it?
How is the real estate business? That's what I want to know.
I feel like I just need an Avis sticker on the back to finish me off.
Yep.
So, all right. So, 3.6, I assume?
Yes.
Thank God.
Hey, there could be worse. It could be the four-cylinder with the only four-speed automatic. I'm going to go out on a limb and say it's probably the only four-speed automatic you can currently buy on the North American market.
I wonder what the Scions have, like the XB.
They have death coming to them. But, okay. So, one of the only four-speed automatics you can buy.
We should do a post on that. How many four-speeds are left?
Word.
We should.
So, what do you think of it?
It's the first time I've driven one with a cloth top, and it looks better, I think, with the cloth. But
blasphemy! It looks like half a Mercedes with the hard top.
It just looks too clunky. It looks more clunky. No, the my biggest thing is the doors. They feel like they weigh like 3,000 pounds each.
They probably do.
I was gonna say they probably do.
I mean, it's like a 1990s convertible.
Yes, except for the
because it is
the Sebring was better.
I actually, when Steven, I was telling him what I got, and I told him I got the Sebring convertible, and I was making fun of it, and then he says, "Do you know you said Sebring and not 200?"
Yeah, and when I say Sebring, note that I mean the JX Sebring, the original Sebring.
I like that one.
Yeah, it was pretty. It looked like a Camaro from the back at a distance.
if you
were a little drunk,
you're awfully pretty, and I'm a little drunk. But so,
it,
but
it
overall,
never seems to amaze me how quickly those cars degraded. You know, like they just deteriorated within 3 years. Like the top had already separated from the bows, and you'd like see them going down the road. They'd do like the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man thing, where they'd like blow up as they're driving down the highway. It's like, what a heap of crap.
Yeah, so is the current 200 convertible in the same league?
Not as the JX, no. I mean, it's not horrible to drive in. It's just horrible to be seen in, I think.
All right.
If our vehicle, a tree fell on it, and they said, we have a Versa or a 200 convertible for you to rent, I'd be like, man, I'm in. Good luck today getting a 200 convertible. But I think that's the only way I would
have to have the Versa, man. I think I would have the Versa over the
200. I live in Florida. It's like perfect convertible weather right now.
It's perfect Versa land, man. Everything's flat. There's no hills. Just get in and roll.
I think it depends on which county in Florida the Versa is more appropriate for versus the Sebring, but or 200. So, but you said it's not horrible to drive. How is it not horrible to drive?
Well, it goes.
Because I mean, this is the car that when Chuck had the Sebring convertible, it made him viscerally angry. I could hear him yelling, just terrible invective.
I mean, looking back at the old. The JX. I mean, they had that 2.5 liter V6 that was like awful, and I mean the engine in this thing is perfect.
Oh, the Pentastar.
The Pentastar is perfect. I love it. Although, no, I'm not going to finish that sentence.
Oh, come on.
I was just gonna say I could see something happening in the future where it's got like some defect and it just has horrible problems down the line, but I'm not gonna jinx it.
It's already happened.
Because I also liked the 2.7 when it first came out, and then that became a sludge master.
Wait. You liked the 2.7? I guess as opposed to the 2.7.
In the Intrepid and the Stratus. In that little Stratus, man, that thing was quick.
Yeah, I can see that. But man, that engine did not age well.
No, it aged fast. Like
yeah,
for years.
I think the Pentastar has a little bit more. It's going to age a little bit more gracefully. I mean, it's in everything, and everything that it's in is it's great. You know, it's a good engine.
But the changes that were made to go from the Sebring to the 200, what they did in such a short amount of time, that's what I'm always impressed about this car, because the Sebring was
bad.
Bad. This is kind of just like
less bad.
Yeah, less bad.
I've been impressed with the interiors in those cars. I think what they did, they put a lot of effort into it, and it shows they could only do so much of a nip and tuck on the styling.
But it's the hard parts of the car. Like, no,
it was a stopgap. I mean, the car was a stopgap measure just to get them through a couple of years until they could stick something else in that slot.
But I mean, I would hate to own this car. I mean, opening the doors, it's a workout. The trunk, that thing is ridiculous because it's like the dual action trunk that opens for the roof, and it also opens to put cargo in it. So just to open it to put some groceries in the back, it feels like it weighs a ton.
So generally the impression that you're left with of the 200 convertible is that it's kind of meaty.
Yeah, it's a little chunky.
Yeah. And how does it actually drive in terms of going down the road? Does it drive like a very heavy caliber, which is essentially what it is?
No, nothing like a caliber. I would not put anything as bad as the caliber, except maybe the early Compasses. But I mean,
yeah.
If I had to drive this thing down to Miami tomorrow, I wouldn't complain.
No, because you'd be going to Miami.
Or if I had to drive this thing to Atlanta tomorrow and sit in Atlanta rush hour traffic.
Okay, but what if you had to drive it to Bemidji?
I don't even know what that is.
What is that?
It's in Minnesota. It's cold.
The seats?
And it's a long way. How are the seats?
I like the seats. The seat heaters come up very quickly.
Tell us more.
Perhaps Jeff Ross isn't the best guest for the podcast. Man, little words. You need to be more erudite.
Seats good. Excellent.
The seats, they hold your ass. Next.
I mean, I haven't driven this car a long distance, but I can. The seats are comfortable. I mean, I can see why people like to rent the car. It's an affordable convertible. It's a comfortable car, and now it's not. The engine isn't garbage.
Well, okay. Look at the 200 convertible and find what it competes with. What does it compete with? So, like, we say it's not horrible. Take it on its own. We'd love to abuse this car, but what are the alternatives?
I guess if you're renting a car, it would be the Mustang convertible.
Yeah.
I could see like a V6 Mustang convertible would compete
totally
pretty
fine.
The Solara used to be there, but it's gone.
Yeah, and I was no fan of the Solara's styling, but I bet even an older Solara is just going to feel quite good even today. I hesitate to say it's going to feel better than the 200 because I know they made so many little detail changes to that car. It definitely outclasses Sebring. So, okay, so we've got the Mustang. Camaro? Is the Camaro sort of priced too high?
Well, if you're gonna put the Mustang in there, you got to put the Camaro. When I think of rental car companies, I think of Caravans, Sebrings, Mustang convertibles, and Versas.
Wow. A veritable cornucopia of
crap. When you go to Orlando, the majority of cars on the road will be one of those four cars.
Yeah, rented by Alamo.
Yep.
That's part of my motivation for not going to Orlando.
That should be the least of your problems going to Orlando.
Yeah. We'll have that conversation later. So I think we've done enough on the 200. Zach, what are you driving?
I have the 2013 Lexus GS450H.
Isn't that a great car?
Damn if it is, man. It's awesome. Yeah. It rolls up in the driveway and it's got that big Predator maw on the front and you're like, okay, well that's a something going on there on a big old luxury hybrid sedan. And you know, you see the hybrid badge and I was a little less than stoked about that. But first off, the interior is gorgeous. It's got the bamboo trim, which looks really good, and it has a massive, massive LCD screen in the center of the dash that can be configured to show all sorts of information, and it's really easy to manipulate with their little trackball pad thing in the center console, which is cool. But this thing's pretty quick. It's I think 0 to 60 is in like the mid 5 second range, which is kind of ludicrous for a car this size.
Yeah, she does zip along.
You know, it's got the V6 and the hybrid motor, and they can cooperate together. I think the V6 turns out like 286 horsepower somewhere on there, and max output from the electric motor is 400. So. You know, I don't know exactly how much of that can be shifted to work together, but there's the potential for quite a bit of thrust, and it's kind of got that, you know, Mr. Jekyll and Dr. Hyde thing.
Dr. Hyde.
I like my version better.
Okay. I will say that
it's a really confusing car in normal mode or eco mode. It's kind of soft and. Yeah, almost too soft, like overly Buicky soft, you know?
Yeah, I did not like eco mode. I don't think it stayed in eco mode very long.
Well, yeah, same. You know, it's got this little drive selector thing, and it's like a little knob, and you turn the knob, and it goes to sport mode, and suddenly the car feels like a normal car, and it's got almost a little... It's going to pain me to say this, but it's almost got a certain amount of BMW-ness about it.
I think there's a lot of BMW-ness in the GS altogether. I feel like the GS350 is better than the 450H because it has more linear response. It's a little slower, I think, than the hybrid, but it's also not the hybrid. So,
well, when I was at the launch of this car, they were selling it against the not the hybrid, but the 350. They're selling it against the E-Class and the 5 Series, and we had it on the track, and it was amazing how well the GS handled itself. I mean, compared to two, I mean, you think E-Class and 5 Series, that's like the pinnacle of performance and midsize luxury, but the GS really handled itself, and I think this is probably one of the best luxury interiors out there.
With the
bamboo, I think the one I had, I mean, just the color combination was like a tan leather with perforated seats.
Oh, with the perforated, so it's the tan semi-aniline leather instead of regular leather, and which they make a big point of talking about, and you're like, it just means it's got the dye all the way through it, guys.
Nope. And it had like the wood on the steering wheel, which... It wasn't.
I don't like.
No, it wasn't.
Why don't
glossy.
You like it?
It wasn't the like the slippery glossy wood. It felt like real wood.
Yeah,
and that's what I liked about it. It didn't. Your hand didn't slide across it. You could actually grip it.
I like the wheels wrapped in like. Actually, my favorite wheel material is suede, just because it wicks the. Sweat off your hands when you
looks like crap in 5,000 miles.
It does. Yeah. It does. If it's true suede, you can hit it with a suede brush and rejuvenate it. If it's Alcantara, it's just going to look like crap. But I think that this car is like Lexus is very serious with the GS, and they're not giving anything up. Where they once had the sort of it's a Lexus and it kind of competes, but it's cheaper, it's better equipped, it's a little bit more smooth and it's certainly more refined, but it doesn't have that life in it that the sports sedans from Europe do.
And that's even with my hossing around on this thing, 29.6 miles to the gallon.
Yeah, it's got that little bit of spark in it now. Like, the motor isn't silky, quiet, smooth. It's definitely smooth, but it's throaty, and you can feel it. You know, you can even just grab the wheel, and you can feel the motor a little bit. And it's a heck of a good car. I was very impressed with the GS.
It also has a heck of a good car price. Mine was sort of lathered up to $68,645.
That's breathtaking, quite honestly.
That is a figure, son.
Wow.
Car starts at just under $59,000 and $5,205 luxury package and the Mark Levinson sound system, which is phenomenal, by the way.
Yes.
Holy crap.
The Levinson sound systems are some of the few that I really like in automobiles. Most car sound systems freaking blow.
Yeah, but it was rocking the speaker grills off.
Yeah, Lexus and the whatever Jaguar uses, was it Meridian?
I
think those are
Bowers and Wilkins.
Yeah, Bowers and Wilkins.
Lexus and Jaguar definitely have two of the best sound systems out there.
So I was shocked at how much I enjoyed this car. It's really not something that I had really been on my radar until I got a hold of it. And freakishly large inside, not a huge trunk. I think the hybrid system sort of soaks up some of the trunk, but man, really, really capacious inside.
But you know, it's interesting, like Jeff, you said when they had the launch event, they had it out there against the E and the 5 Series, and my brain immediately said, bollocks, it's not that big. It didn't feel like...
Oh, it is.
And I know it is, but it just, like, the 5 feels like relaxed fit, and so does the E, where this feels a bit more tidy, and just maybe it's just because of the driving impression of the GS that it feels that way. But
no, it's funny, this one had that whole, you know, thing where you open the door and the seat slides back so you can fit your, you know.
Oh, I shut that crap off.
Inside.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, it had it on it when I first got it. So get in and realize that I couldn't reach the pedals.
Yeah.
Like, wow, this is some serious space we got going on in here.
That happens to me on a regular basis. It doesn't really matter. That happens to me in Fiat 500s.
Yeah, I'd keep that to yourself. Yeah. It's the best course action there.
Yeah. All right. Well, now that I've embarrassed myself.
What are you driving?
I have a Cadillac SRX 4 with the 3.6. And I'm still not enamored of the way the SRX looks, mostly because of that sort of shovely nose. But damn if this isn't a really good Equinox.
Yeah?
I like it. It's quiet. It's punchy. Because I've had the Equinox with the 4-cylinder, and that it was okay. But with the V6, this platform really comes alive a bit. You know, it's got plenty of oomph to get out of its own way. It also gets terrible fuel economy with it, pulling down like 19 miles per gallon.
Ouch.
You know, that whole segment is just stuffed with cars that get really abysmal fuel economy. I just finished up writing up the review of the FX37, and I was pretty appalled by its fuel economy, which sits right there at like 19 or so. And the only thing that even gets decent fuel economy is the X3, the Q5, the
Which Q5 though? Because
the one with the big V6. What is that? The 3.2.
Yeah, that's right. They came. I didn't think it got that terrible fuel economy.
It's pretty bad. The RX 350, also really bad and not that powerful. All those cars are batting right there at like 21, 22 combined. It's pretty bad.
Yeah,
which is baffling because they're really small. They don't have a lot of capability in terms of, you know, towing prowess. So where the hell is all that fuel economy going? I guess it's just a big, tall.
They're heavy
box.
Too.
Heavy.
How much that SRX weighs?
I bet it weighs a lot over 4,000 pounds. It feels solid, but my guess is because it feels so solid, it weighs a lot because it's probably made solid the old way, which is lots more metal instead of stuff like high strength steel and things like that. I mean, it drives really well. It's a nice, nice vehicle. It's comfortable. It's luxurious. I was thinking about this as I was driving it. I'm not sure what in this segment I might pick over. I mean, the X3, I hated the original X3. I like the current one, although I feel like it's really abusively overpriced, and the automatic transmission makes me want to light it on fire.
What's the sticker on the SRX?
This one is it's not that bad. I think it was like 53.
Yeah, you could get an FX37 for that, and I would have that day in and day out.
The FX, I think, has I'm not sure about this, but I think the FX has less usable space inside.
Although
the SRX, quite honestly, like, I was shocked by how small the back seat is in the SRX. You know, the Lexus RX has a bigger back seat. The X3 certainly does. You pay. And I was like, well, but it looks like it should have more room. Like, why is there not that much space in here? And I guess it's just because it's not space efficient. But I would much, much prefer the SRX over the RX, any Lexus RX. I don't know why that vehicle sells so well, because that is one of the worst Lexus vehicles there is, in my opinion.
Yeah, I agree with that. Just if we could go back to the 450H.
Yes, sir.
Sorry. I just
you're pulling a Roth.
I know, something just jumped in my head there real quick. So it has a traction control off button that doesn't turn the traction control off.
No.
Why do cars do that?
Lawyers.
If I have a car that's theoretically approaching, 500 horsepower, occasionally I might like to do juvenile things with said car, right? Like, yeah, smoky burnouts where I can take pictures of a hybrid doing a massive burnout that would have been awesome for, a lead shot. Nope, can't do that.
See, the flip side is they're really afraid that you're going to do that and you'll get all high on that electric motor torque and you'll just slide right into a busload of nuns and fire will ensue, and then you'll survive. You'll walk away and we'll tragically have lost a problem like Maria, and all of a sudden you'll turn around and sue Lexus because their car had a button that you could defeat.
Well, it's amazing how many cars you push the traction control button, you go to do a burnout, and the light comes right on, and it doesn't let you do anything.
Whoa, son, what are you doing there?
We're just here for looks. Don't touch me.
I fully support the anti-burnout thing, because I don't like burnouts. It's whatever.
Damn, God.
But I despise
you are things. So un-American.
No, that's not true.
The next thing out of your mouth is going to be like, I don't like beer or breasts. That's what's those are the next two words coming out of your mouth. I swear it.
Chicken, male. Never mind. Let's categorize. But anyway, I love beer and I like donuts, both the yummy, tasty kind and the kind you do in vehicles. And you can't do donuts, especially not in a snowy parking lot, when the traction control won't shut the hell up.
That's true.
So I agree that
it's also useful for, teaching car control. Like, I have no idea how I'm going to be able to teach my children car control.
You're not going to have to worry about it, Zach. Your cars are all shit boxes without any kind of stability.
True. Just put them in the horse and be like, go that way for a while. Quickly. Sorry. So yeah.
No, SRX. That's fine. I have nothing more to say about the SRX other than it's black. So I felt like I was driving the modern day funeral director vehicle.
Nice.
But it's nice, Cadillac luxury. GM did a nice job with this vehicle. So I can. I guess our penance is the E-Assist Malibu. Yeah. It's one of those examples of GM doing. They're so.
I'm just gonna go ahead and make the Malibu Eco the Voldemort of the Autoblog podcast. do not speak its name.
All right,
that's how it's gonna go.
And maybe some more things that we can sort of never speak of them again are the high efficiency trims that apparently cost you money. Twice. They cost you money to buy, and they ding your resale value. We have
Yield the double shaft. That's pretty brutal.
Yeah.
Good old double shaft.
And I think you only get $5 a year back in fuel savings from these. We had a post about it with a little report about how they don't really help you out, because I guess Cars.com did a study and they they found that, they cost more to buy, and then on the resale market, people tend to stay away from them. Why would that be?
Well, because they typically suck to drive, which is a damn shame because, you know, the Cruise Eco is probably, it's a really good car to drive, especially with the 6-speed manual. It's probably one of the better cruises to have. I guess my hang-up with all these, super fuel efficiency models has always been, well, why isn't that just the standard tech for the car, right?
Well, like, because it costs more to produce, I guess.
Okay, well, thank you.
Not only
you.
That, I mean, some of them, they dumb down the transmission. They add the more expensive tires. Like, when I first read this, I thought that's what it was going to be, like all the extra stuff. Like, I would hate to think how much replacing low rolling resistance tires will be.
No, you don't. You just stick whatever else is around.
Yeah, it's stuff like that. I mean, that's where all the mileage comes from. So if you go into a tire store and you see what's supposed to be on there and then what can fit on there, chances are you're just going to get the cheap stuff. And then after a while, you're just going to have a car that has poor shifting.
Well, I think that the Cruise Eco is a special case because it's actually one of the few that stands apart from the pack. It's effective. It gets you more fuel economy than the regular Cruise by like 4 or 5 miles per gallon, which is more significant than the general, like just like the SFE package or, Hyundai with the fuel economy option. But it's not representative of the entire class. You know, the Cruise Eco has the active shutters. It has the nicer wheels. You can get it with a manual. Like, all of the things in that car, that is, like, the perfect cruise, in my opinion. It's fantastic. And yet, if I were to get into most cars, even cars with, like, an Eco button, usually I get very angry with the Eco stuff. And I realize that's me, and I just have an issue.
No, it's funny because the guys who drop off the cars, they always put the cars in Eco mode. I don't know why this happens.
Do you
but like the first like 3 miles, I'm like, what the hell is going on with this car? There's zero power. The throttle response is abysmal. And I look down, there's a little Eco badge on. So the next 5 minutes, me hunting around the cabin looking for the button to turn off.
It's even worse when the automaker hides it like in the menu that you can't get to unless you're parked.
Yeah,
you have to find out where to get to the menu, and then it says, oh, you can't use me because you're moving.
Yeah, that's it's just a dirty trick. And the thing is, like, they're not allowed to use that stuff, like the Eco mode. They can't use that for the EPA tests, so it's just in there to,
for no reason.
I don't know. It's just in there to infuriate people, I guess, or people just like the feeling of a car that is completely unresponsive.
It's the piece of paper. I mean, it says 40 mpg on that sticker, and that's what people are going to buy. I mean, when the whole thing came down with Kia and Hyundai, I mean, the extra 1 or 2 miles per gallon, it doesn't cost you that much, but the difference between 39 and 40 is a lot psychologically.
It's one.
It's also the loneliest number.
Two can be as bad as one. It's the loneliest number since the number one.
The bottom line is don't buy the fuel efficiency package. You're gonna pay more, and you're gonna get less out of it. Once you sell it, it's not gonna do you that much better.
It's gonna do you worse. It's gonna cost you like $300 when you go to that. That was in their study. They found a 2010 Kia Forte that had the fuel economy package was like $238 less than the regular Forte, which means that the Forte is not very good to drive to begin with. That car, especially with a manual,
so bad.
But then it's also going to ding you extra because nobody wants to drive the fuel economy Forte,
right?
So,
just embarrassing.
Yeah, bear in mind when you're out there buying that the fuel economy is gonna. Just you're not gonna make anything off it. It's not gonna save you money.
This whole fuel economy thing is just a fad.
It's like the internet. If you really want economy, drive less, or buy a diesel, or get a hybrid.
True.
Or a Leaf. Yeah. Or if your money bags, get a Tesla Model S, and then you can
put prices
and you can do burnouts.
Model S isn't really that expensive. I mean, it's pricey, but It's not that pricey.
Things going well for you down there?
No, I mean, just in terms of, like, look at a well-loaded 5 Series, right?
Well, a well-loaded 5 Series is kind of, like, these days, I would not be surprised if you could push a 5 Series to $90,000.
Well, that's what I'm saying. It's not obscene money for the type of car that the Model S is. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah. I mean, the Model S is just flat-out awesome, and I think it deserves every accolade it gets. I mean, they started a car company. They built essentially kit car Lotuses with electric motors. And then all of a sudden, bam, we've got the Model S, which is probably the most fully realized car launch in years.
In America, no less. Yeah.
Just impressive. It's great that a South American businessman, South African businessman. Never mind, moving on.
It's all the same to you, isn't it?
South, it's below the equator, who cares? Speaking of economy, 2014 Mazda 6. This looks like it might be a much more interesting Mazda 6 than the one that is leaving Flat Rock. And I'll just leave that out there.
Okay. So these cars, I mean, first off, there's no denying just how freaking gorgeous they are. And they should drive pretty well. Mazda's always done, you know, vehicles that, you know, that zoom zoom thing isn't just a load of crap. They actually do drive pretty smart. And you know, the news that they were throwing their full suite of Skyactiv tech at the car is good news, with a more efficient engine and transmission, and, you know, lighter cars seemed great. And now they've got the EPA ratings back, and it is good for up to 38 miles per gallon highway out of the just straight regular 2.5 liter gasoline four cylinder
with the automatic. And that's the Skyactiv automatic, which is surprisingly really satisfying to drive.
If you want the 6-speed manual, it's 37 miles per gallon highway, which is pretty freaking good, I gotta say.
But Jeff, I mean, like, you're looking at this car, I'm looking at this car anyway, and I'm just thinking, like, what just happened? We just had a whole new crop of these this class, you know. We've got things like the new Accord and the new Fusion and the new Altima. Like, is this going to get lost?
I don't think so in terms of its styling. I don't think Mazda can keep up with the production numbers of any of the other cars. So I think it will kind of get lost in that regard. But, you know, it's... To me, I always liked the last Mazda 6. When it first came out in, 2008, 2009, I thought it was a really sharp-looking car. And then it aged quickly. And I'm wondering how these new midsize sedans are going to do in regards of styling, because that's what everyone's going on now. Everyone's pushing style in this midsize class. So I'm kind of interested to see how that goes with all these cars.
Yeah, well, and I mean, I think there's some substance to this new Mazda 6, generally because it's based on the CX-5, which we've all pretty much professed our love for the way it rides and handles, if not the fact that it needs more power. So that bodes well. It could be one of the vehicles that just tops out all the magazine tests. But in terms of real-world sales, I don't know how much that's going to help it. I mean, the Fusion and the Accord look like they're the two cars to beat in terms of volume, especially now that they added more volume, well, in the Camry, but they added more volume to the Fusion line, the Fusion assembly. And the Mazda 6 has been actually pulled from Ford joint-owned production facilities, and I think they're going to produce them all in Japan. So I don't know that Mazda's really even thinking, like, hey, we're going to sell so many of these, they're going to be like veritable hotcakes. And we've been over the hotcake territory again. you know, I think that they'll find a niche, I hope, anyway. I mean, aren't they supposed to put a diesel in this sack?
They certainly are, and they haven't released the EPA numbers or the price tag. And, you know, that's the other thing. The 2014 Mazda 6 will start at $20,880 plus an $800 destination fee somewhere around there. So,
do you think the diesel will have better than the Fusion's 47 miles per gallon?
That is a steep number. I hope so. I don't know. We'll see.
I think that it might drive better than the Fusion Hybrid.
I'm sure it will.
Because it's just a diesel. And it'll have torque.
Torque.
Every now and then we just need to sort of
torque it up.
Yeah. So
you boys alone.
I'm good, thanks. We should remind everybody that the Autoblog podcast is brought to you by TireRack.com, the leading online source for tires and so much more, including a large selection of winter tires, as well as aftermarket wheels, suspension, and brake components, and those items that make it easier to see, like windshield wipers and replacement lighting. So no matter what your vehicle, check them out at TireRack.com. And speaking of the aftermarket and used vehicles, so nobody spoke of that, but Chrysler has been to CES and they've talked about adding dealer level navigation to their Uconnect system. So if you were to buy a used Chrysler from 2013 on, I believe, you can actually add navigation to the Uconnect system after the fact, which to me, that's one of the things, because I'm not buying new cars. So when we were looking before we decided to stop looking, I was looking at Ford Edges going, oh, I could put nav in that, because you just buy the head unit on eBay and it'll plug and play in that particular car. It's not like that in every vehicle. So that's actually pretty slick. I'm surprised that it took them that long to come up with that idea. I mean, Jeff, you used to work as a tech.
This sounds like it's just a software upgrade too. Because like the Sebring I'm in right now, Sebring 200.
they're never going to live that down.
Holy crap.
They probably do that in Auburn Hills too. They're probably like, damn it.
But I've driven a lot of Chrysler vehicles since they've gotten Uconnect, and they all have the same head unit. The only difference is the ones without nav don't have a little nav button. So it looks like it has navigation. You're sitting there trying to find it and you can't. And I think that's been a big frustration, and the fact that they look the same, it does make sense that they're adding this now, but it does seem like the example they give is the new touchscreen version with the 8.4, it looks like. I don't know, just by the picture with the buttons at the bottom. So I'm guessing it's just like a software thing.
But I this doesn't it strike you as a good idea? Like, I know
it's a great idea.
With my cars, especially my older crap box cars, I would go to the junkyard looking for options that my cars never came with. And it just seems like a good idea. Like, what's your alternative? You buy, like, say you go shopping for, like, I'm trying to pick a vehicle that's going to have like a completely obsolete nav system, a Jaguar, right? You get like a couple of years old Jaguar,
and the nav is just still have an obsolete navigation system today.
Yeah, that's true. And can you even get them without nav? I think my whole example just
deteriorated right there. You shouldn't have gone with Jaguar.
Crumbled,
swing and a miss,
right in front of my face. A Honda, Honda Pilot.
I think what they're going for here, I mean, if you can't get navigation, everyone can get nav on their cell phone. So I think they're just trying to kind of take away from the smartphone market.
Well, it seems like a smart way to upsell from the dealer's side, you know?
Yeah, I don't think the dealers are going to complain about it. And it is nice. Like, yeah, I have nav on my phone that'll work when I'm in a car without nav, but the integrated systems are nicer. You know, the screens are bigger. I don't have a
phone. And safer.
Screen. Yeah, nice. And safer. You can talk to them. I could probably talk to my phone and make it do nav, but I'd probably end up throwing it before I figured it out. It seems like a really good idea, and the smartphone integration thing, I think we're going to see more of that as well, where it's you know Ford is opening up at CES their app link to everybody. Basically, they're saying, here, we made this, you have it, please, and go off and develop applications that will wonderfully work with our system. Look at this thing we built. You can use it, and then we benefit because you develop apps for our system. So I think that we're going to see a lot more of this tech stuff, and keeping an eye on what's going on at CES. There's a lot of that sort of everything is tied to what a smartphone can do for you in your car. So I don't know. It's a good idea.
I'm down with it.
Yeah. And Uconnect is easy to use, so Hooray. And while we're on the selling and buying car tip, we should talk about the best and worst selling vehicles of 2012 and what that says about us as a collective nation. Which do you guys want to start with?
We should start with the best. Start with the best.
Okay.
But the worst is more fun.
All right. Number 10 bestseller is the... Yes. These are the best. Make sure I have to write this. It's the Ford Escape, which moved 261,000 units. My guess is that that's the old Escape.
Jeff, you're an old Escape owner.
We bought ours in 2011. Okay. I'm not part of that 008.
Yes, but you understand the appeal.
Yes, I do. And actually, we bought ours when the new one was coming out, and we bought ours because we liked it better. So I think there will still be people like that. I mean, you give up so much in just the functionality and the technology, but it's that old school, you know, the boxy kind of cool look to it as opposed to the big Focus look.
I have to say I was... The new Escape, I was excited for it to arrive and to try it out. And then after 5 minutes of driving, I go, oh, well, that question's answered.
A really, really horrible back end. Like, its design in the back end is a disaster.
The front end's no good either, really.
The front end's fine. The front end I can entirely tolerate because the rest of the segment isn't exactly, you know, beautiful machinery. But the rear end is just—it's like a big slab. It looks like Olmec from you know that horrible Nick show. I guess not. Nobody knows the Temple Olmec. Anyway. Nope. All right. Well, that.
Hey, why don't you buy a Jaguar with Nav?
I should do that. Maybe I'll do that. Maybe Olmec will drive me around to the past Temple Guards. Anyway, funny.
Yeah, no, but that's okay. We'll let the joke die. I just the new Escape just doesn't do it for me, and this is probably actually the new and the old together.
Yeah, because the new Escape, I think it went on sale earlier in the year, like before mid-year.
Yeah. But that doesn't mean that there weren't old Escapes that were selling gangbusters.
Plus I'm sure the multiple recalls on the new Escape didn't help at all.
It's kind of funny to see that the Ford Escape dropped 5 points on the list, though. Right? Like last year, the year before, it sold enough to gain the 5th place on the list, and now it's 10th. That's a serious drop.
Did it actually drop in sales, or everyone else just did so much better?
Couldn't answer that question. Could not do that. So since we have 10 of these, Dan, we want to move along, or... Honda CR-V was number 9, 281,652 units. That's no real surprise. I mean,
it was unranked last year, which is a surprise to me.
It is a shock. You would have thought that would have taken a larger chunk.
Well, it was. Is this the new CR-V or is it the again the old CR-V? Who cares?
I don't know.
I like the CR-V better than the Escape.
I'm the other way around. No. I'm not a huge fan of either. But I like the Escape more.
But I tolerate the one that's in my driveway.
If I have to pick, typhoid or dysentery.
No, I like the one we have. I'm talking about the new Escape and the new CR-V.
Gotcha. No, that makes sense.
I like the new CR-V better.
I haven't driven either. I've spent a little bit of time in the Escape, but that's pretty much it.
Yeah, the new Escape is just, it doesn't have any charm like the old Escape. And so, number 8, speaking of completely without charm, Toyota Corolla. I'm surprised this is not higher. It's like consistent with last year, too. It was number 8 last year.
Yeah, it's just kind of a shock.
Yeah. And we're going to have a new one. Maybe the new one will do better.
I've said this before. I think Toyota puts a mixture of cocaine and bacon in the seat material. There's no other reason why that car sells so much.
Reputation.
I don't know.
Yeah.
It's completely uninspiring to drive. But
I mean, yeah, the new Corolla is at least 10 years old.
Right now, with 0 miles.
Yeah.
But people want that. I don't know who, but people.
290,947 of them.
Yeah. Yeah. But I I have much more respect for the 293,363 people that bought the Ram pickup, which is number 7.
Is that the new one or the old one?
Who knows? Are you making fun of me? Are you mocking me?
It's definitely the old one. I don't think the new one's even out yet.
I don't know.
It came out in November.
Last year it was number 7. So there you go. Ram has Toyota-like consistency in its rankings. Don't honestly know if that's true, but that is a heck of a pickup, and I'm surprised that this list wasn't all trucks actually for top selling vehicles in the U.S. We got the Altima at number 6, the Honda Civic at number 5,
which was unranked last year in the top 10.
Yeah, now that's surprising that it completely fell off the map.
Unless, I mean, maybe the weird numbers from the tsunami affected things.
That's a possibility.
Now that I think about it.
Yeah, because the Accord moved up a lot, actually, from 9 to 4 this year. So they're doing a lot better with the Accord. And that's built in the U.S., whereas I think the Civics were coming from Japan, weren't they? Or am I completely...
Some Civics are built in Indiana.
Okay, so I don't know what I'm talking about. The Civic just... People reacted quite well to it this year, and... I don't know, something else was on the list last year. I mean, the Fusion is not on this list, actually, and it was on it last year. And I was again surprised to see that it's not on here. But maybe
it is an intrigue.
Yeah. Completely unsurprising is the Toyota Camry. 404,000 of those.
That is a lot. That is a serious number.
It's a lot of Camrys.
I will be so surprised when the Camry outsells the Silverado. I mean, it's right there.
It's gunning for it, isn't it? It's really close.
Yeah, it was just maybe...
Okay, and why isn't the Sierra on this list?
The Sierra probably doesn't move enough to make it on the list. Now, why don't they... see, because they do the F-Series, right? At 645,000, that's number 1. And the Silverado is 418. Why don't they put, like, GMT 900s? Because the Sierra and the Silverado are the same thing.
Well.
Come out of the same plant.
Well, that's because they sell them under two different brands. Yeah. Like,
I mean, the Silverado has the HD. The Silverado has as many.
But you can get versions. A Sierra HD.
Same thing. But it's a different truck, they say.
And you hear this argument a lot. All the time, people say, like, well, if you combine the GMCs and the Chevrolets, then they would outsell the Ford F-Series.
I guess it would be like combining the Fords and the Lincolns to say, like, look, we sold 100,000 Tauruses and MKSs.
I think this year, the F-Series outsold Silverado and Sierra.
Yeah, I think they did, like, with combined. It wasn't too far behind the Silverado and the Sierra. So, anyway, these are your top 10 best-selling vehicles for 2012. God, we're boring.
Yeah, we're really, really boring people.
We are boring farmers.
If you want to not think boring, just imagine how many of those F-Series trucks were Raptors. Then it makes it a little less boring.
No, when I think of the F-Series trucks, I'm just like, okay, how many have a Harley-Davidson sticker on one of the back windows and the Calvin peeing on stuff on the other?
No, most of them.
No, that won't be for at least a couple of years.
Most of them are white with steel wheels, and
they have a little flashing light on the top.
Yeah, and they say Comcast on the door. keep sending off my porch. Get out of here. All right, so we predominantly buy uninspiring vehicles. The list of worst sellers has way, way more fun. Which is probably why they don't sell as well, because they're quirky.
Oh, man. There is one manufacturer that just owns this list, buddy.
Yeah. Tell me what. No, there's only one with two entries. Is that
the
one you're talking
about? Yeah.
Well, yeah. I'm surprised that the worst selling vehicle. Like, okay. Some of the worst selling vehicles are just there by. I don't know. I think it's like a cheap shot.
I feel so bad for the C30. I really like that car. That's a totally acceptable car. And it hit number 10.
Yeah, because they only sold 2,800 of them.
God, it hurts so bad. But
those are Saab numbers.
Sells F-Series that in a day.
Yeah. That's probably
You know, the C30 is decent, but its biggest problem is the fact is that it's a Mazda 3.
That it's a two-door hatchback.
Yeah, it looks
weird looking,
right? But it's
space, and it's stupid expensive.
Yeah, it can be very.
Yeah, it says MSRP 25.5, but yeah,
that's like, for like the version 1.0 with no options.
That's with three wheels. The fourth wheel is an extra demand.
I'm actually going to be driving a C30. I saw it on my list. I was like, whoa, they still make that thing?
Not anymore.
Is it the Polestar? Because the Polestar is freaking awesome.
I don't know. It doesn't say the model.
It's probably the Polestar. The C30 is dead after this year. It's done. So
makes me so sad. It was a good-looking car. It was a cool car.
It's a good-looking car. Especially after they went with the new front end.
See, I don't like the new front end as much. But
Dan, you don't like anything.
I don't like change, Sonny.
No, you don't.
BMW Z4 is the ninth worst-selling vehicle, which doesn't really...
Yeah, that's a weird car. And it's really attractive, and I'm sure it drives really well, and it's got a lot of power, but it's also stupid expensive.
I don't know, 47,350.
For a Z4?
I don't know.
Which is a Corvette, right about that price, I think.
Yes.
No, you cannot
get
a, can you get a Corvette starting?
Yes.
I don't think so.
All right, keep talking.
I would so much rather have a Corvette.
I know.
The Z4 is the car that Shunk roasted the clutch out of, I believe. Or it roasted the clutch out of itself. On the way to golf.
$49,600 for a Corvette.
Oh, that's like like a couple of steak dinners away. You might as well just buy that.
Plus, if you get any options on that Z4, it's going to be $60,000 before you know it.
Yeah, and let me tell you something about BMW dealers. They don't stock cars without options. You know why? Because they don't sell. So there. Yeah. But these are sales, too. I wonder what the mix is between, like, oh, I guess it doesn't really matter. Yeah, I was going to say leases, but who owns the leased cars? Do the dealerships own the leased cars, or do the...
Usually it's a third party, like a bank or something.
We are completely displaying our lack of depth on this subject, so let's move on. Another German coupe. Look at this, the bottom of this...
Another car I love.
It's all European, coupes, though.
A horrible list. These are all my darling children. TTRS, phenomenal car.
Yeah, and they didn't break it up.
TTS... pretty freaking good.
But what about the regular TT? The regular TT is just a beetle.
This gets a little more interesting because right here you're looking at $8,000 less than the Z4. So, I mean, you're starting to get into that kind of affordable personal car. So, I don't see why it sells so little, but maybe because there's a lot of options out there.
Because it's a two-seater. And it's inherently impractical.
Well, lots of things. Cocaine is impractical, but it sells really well.
It is not impractical. You get lots of stuff done. It can be a completely practical tool.
Good Lord.
All right, so
don't do drugs, kids. I feel obliged to say that. As always, don't listen to Dan.
Listen, caffeine, all that, it's just coffee. Anyway, speaking of stuff you'd have to be high to take, the Subaru Tribeca, which I actually... you know what I'm going to say. I like the Tribeca.
God, good. How is that possible?
Because it's got that...
Of all the Subarus, it is the worst Subaru.
If you made me drive an Outback or the Tribeca, I would definitely take an Outback.
Oh, and it's so big, the Tribeca.
So much more affordable, too.
Yeah, of course it is. The Tribeca is expensive. It's got that flat six that's in.
It's ugly.
You're describing every Subaru, Zach. You know,
no, it's not ugly anymore. Now it's just bland.
It looks like Saabs because it's what it was supposed to be.
Yeah, when it was the original Tribeca, was ugly.
You know what though? I like how bonkers crazy that original Tribeca was, especially because if you squint, you can see Alfa Romeo in it. So that
don't make no sense.
Whatever. That vehicle completely deserves to be on the list. I mean, I don't even see the Tribeca up here that much in super crazy New England. So, Suzuki Equator, which isn't even a Suzuki, is number six. That, again, doesn't surprise me. I saw one of those a couple days ago. Shocked the hell out of me.
If you're in the market for a pickup truck right now and you're even considering a Nissan Frontier, you'd be an idiot not to buy an Equator.
Zach loves the Frontier. Don't really? Zach.
I'm just saying, you could probably get a steal of an Equator right now.
Probably. Yeah, probably.
It's the same truck. You could take it to the Nissan dealership tomorrow, and I bet they'd work on it.
Well, would you take it to the Nissan dealer because it needed work, or would you take it
because you have a Suzuki dealership?
Yeah, like, hey, will you guys work on this thing? And they said,
only the Nissan dealership sold Suzukis, and you could actually find one.
Yeah, so you'd have, you probably have to go far and wide to find a Suzuki. The Cadillac Escalade EXT
also breaks my heart. Great truck.
It's an Avalanche. You don't like Avalanche, but you like the EXT?
What do they call the Suburban one? What is that?
The ESV?
Yeah, the damn fucking acronyms. Yeah, no, that's true. It's all right, wrong. Yeah. No, it's totally fine.
Nissan GTR!
Okay, now this one, there's a caveat here. So the rule on this was the cars had to be under $100,000, and the GTR just barely squeaked
under
it.
Under $100,000.
So that's why they only sold 1,200 of them last year.
And it's a niche car. Expensive. It's like, it's supposed to be rare.
Right. So that's fine.
And speaking of another niche enthusiast car, the Acura ZDX is number 3.
That makes me so happy to see that car there.
Oh, come on. It really does.
Screw that car.
It moved up a spot from last year.
Good.
Yeah, they sold less of it.
May it continue to crash and burn. That's all I can say to that.
The only thing I didn't like about the ZDX, I've driven it a handful of times.
There's just one thing you didn't like about it?
Yes. There's only one thing I don't like about that. It's the floor. It's too high, so...
It's like riding around in an 80s Toyota pickup.
Your knees are so high up because they give it so much ground clearance, and then they make the roof so low, you only have like a foot of space.
Yeah, that's probably its most glaring problem, which I didn't really find to be that big a deal. I noticed it, but since I'm, you know, short, it doesn't matter. But I love the style of that. I love the...
Yeah, I have never hated the ZDX.
Yeah. I guess everybody else does, though.
Except for 775 people.
Yeah, that is a paltry amount of sales. Paltry, I say.
Paltry.
Mitsubishi Lancer Sportback. That one surprised me.
Did it really?
Yeah, because A, I see them around, and B, like, they don't strike me as like that bad of an affordable little hatchbacky kind of thing.
I think the thing here is... The Lancer Sportback's broken out. You don't see a lot of other models broken out.
Right,
like
that's true.
Like the EXT, if you folded that in with Escalade, that would definitely not be on the list.
Yeah.
That's a good point.
But I see Lancers all over the place. I never see Sportbacks.
I haven't seen one in a while, so maybe it was just like the same one I kept seeing over and over again. I don't know. And Mitsubishi, see, this is where Zach... proves his point that they're
drum roll.
The iMiEV.
iMiEV.
The i.
That's just probably like. It's definitely the worst named vehicle on the market.
And it's a $30,000 golf cart.
Right, it's like a gem.
600 people bought that last year.
Were they all in the same retirement community down there?
No, they all live in New York and LA.
Also, that makes it the worst-selling car in America for the second year in a row. So, hats off to you, Mitsubishi. Good job.
Yeah.
I don't know what happened. When they were putting this list together, the Eclipse was on there twice.
I wish we could hand out an award for this, like a bronzed pile of poo.
I think the fact that they're losing their shirt on every single one of the iMiEVs they sell... iMiEV, whatever.
I have no idea what they're actually supposed to. How you?
Yeah.
Actually supposed.
I just call it the Mitsubishi i.
Yeah. They're not making any money on that if they're only selling 600. Not even 600. Like it's just it costs more to import them and store them and have somebody browbeat you into buying one. Then there's no return on that. So whatever. Hats off. Although I think Mitsubishi is not going to go the way of Suzuki. We're going to see Mitsubishi hanging around. You know who I'm very surprised to not see on this list at all?
Lincoln.
That is kind of shocking.
Okay, Lincoln altogether sold 85,000 vehicles roughly this year. That's like pretty new cars like the MKS and the MKZ. The MKZ was their best seller at 28,000. A 20-something-year-old design at Ford outsold all of Lincoln by a wide margin, and that is the E-Series van.
Well, again, going back to the F-Series.
A lot of fleet.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, completely unfair. I get that. Mustang completely outsold all of Lincoln. Again, probably unfair. Let's go to a niche vehicle that hasn't really caught on. Transit Connect. 35,000 Transit Connects.
Still a lot of fleet.
Yeah, I guess, but they outsold, like, a really nice really nice is relative, but a Fusion. They outsold a version of the Fusion.
How many Taurus did they sell? Like that's
Ford sold 75,000 Tauruses if you count cop cars.
Yeah.
Nearly the Taurus, which is completely unloved, sold almost as much as all of
them. How long are they going to continue to nurse that brand along?
Not very.
I don't understand that. We've had this conversation over and over again. Just let it die.
Yeah, well, they're not getting the MKC, their version of the Escape. That's not hitting dealerships till like spring of 2014. So yeah, Lincoln, start saying that goodbye now.
That happened just before Mercury was going away. Oh yeah, we're getting these great products in two more years. Just wait for it.
Yeah, Mercury never had any great products
except the Cougar
in the 2000s.
Cougar,
the Cougar. What exactly is the Cougar?
The Cougar.
The Cougar.
The little coupe.
Wouldn't that be the Cougar?
No, that's how my wife says, or at least she's from the Maryland area, and I guess she said they say Cougar.
Oh. Well, they say a lot of weird stuff in Maryland. Isn't it? It's not Maryland, it's Merlin.
Merlin. That's how they say it in Alabama.
Yeah.
If they're referring to Maryland, it's Merlin.
Merlin. Yeah, in Alabama, you drink Sebmup. Yeah, we should stop. We should talk about some of our questions from the Q&A. And
none of them are from Alabama or Maryland.
No, we got one from Detroit, from Lavelle, and he's asking, with Infiniti renaming its whole lineup Q and QX, will they get the crown for most confusing lineup of vehicles? If not, who owns that crown?
Lincoln.
Yeah, I was going to say Lincoln because I get them completely confused all the time.
And we write about the industry. That's what kills me.
Like, yeah.
How is anybody supposed to keep that straight when it is our sole job to keep that stuff organized and we can't manage to do it?
Yeah, but I mean, okay, in our defense, how often do we write about Lincoln? We're writing about them more now as they're like sort of on the, like their death rattle has started. That's true. They don't really pop up otherwise.
That's true.
Well, one thing I always thought interesting about Lincoln, especially now that they're getting the MKC, or they say they're getting it.
My prediction is they won't make it.
But I'm in Miami a lot, and some Hispanic languages, they pronounce Z, and it sounds like a C. So they say MKC, and they're referring to the MKZ. So you know, now they're going to have two cars that sound alike. You know, that's just the problem that I've thought about.
It would be MK say though, right? The C is
right.
But no, if someone down there or anywhere who speaks Spanish with that, I mean, it's that kind of dialect they have.
Right, but C is
the Z kind of sounds like a C.
Yeah.
So you know, if they're talking to me and they're saying, "Yeah, I drove the MKC," and then there is an actual MKC,
you have to listen for the subtleties.
Yeah. I don't listen to subtle things.
Yeah.
Try not to listen.
That's all right. Lincoln's not going to have enough. They're not going to make it. You're not going to have to worry about it. So Whitney from Ohio asks, apparently we have touched a nerve with Whitney. Have you had any experience of 1994 to 2004 domestic vehicles? You have dissed on the Monte Carlo. Have you ever experienced the toughness or power of the GM 3.8? My father bought a new 98 Bonneville non-supercharged. He drove in a manner that would result in jail time today. Probably would have resulted in jail time yesterday as well.
And back then.
Yeah. He drove it for 300,000 kilometers. What is that, like? 6,000 miles
somewhere around there. Yeah.
Before he handed it down. Yeah, the 3800, great engine. It took him 40 years to get it right, and the rest of the car was a flaming ball of crap. That's why we bag on them, because they suck.
I mean, yeah, so my argument to that is go to Pull Apart or any junkyard that deals with fairly new vehicles and count the number of vehicles with the 3.8 in it. It's staggering.
It's not the engine's fault. It's the rest of the car.
Right. I mean, it's... Yeah.
I mean...
Okay. Sometimes it is the engine's fault, but yes.
Not in the W platform GMs. Like, they started off as the GM10, okay? And that's what he's talking about, right? It's the sort of... any front-wheel drive GM from, gosh, the Citation to pretty much... the Malibu of what? What was the Malibu? Not the late 90s one. The one that had that funky hatchback.
The Max?
Malibu Max?
Yeah. That was probably the first decent GM front-wheel drive car. Was that one. And it wasn't very good. But that became the 2008 Malibu, and then, you know, whatever.
What was wrong with the Celebrity? I like the Celebrity.
The Celebrity was a hunk of junk.
It was not.
It was based on the X-Car.
You take it back. I will drive up to Boston.
In a Celebrity?
I have to say.
Whoa. Choose your words carefully.
Yeah, go
here,
ahead.
Jeff.
No. Rock a Eurosport, all right? Rock a Eurosport, please.
I think you should find a Celebrity, buy it, and drive it to Boston.
When I was in college, one of the guys that we made movies with, he had a Celebrity. But we were film students, so one of the guys had a car. It was a Celebrity, a black Celebrity, so we all called it Shaft.
Could you dig it?
Oh, we could dig it. And it had a stereo from... I think it had a Chrysler stereo in it, nice. Which I thought was hilarious.
A Celebrity saved my life.
Which one?
Was it Sarah McLachlan? Were you at an SPCA?
Yeah, it was a little dog.
Were you a sad puppy?
In a past life.
My daughter watches those ads and she reads the subtitles. I'm like, oh, it's going to break your heart. Don't. Don't. It's designed to just do that. But no, I mean, okay, the A-bodies, the front-wheel drive A-bodies were much better than the supposedly revolutionary GM10s that were the Luminas that took like a couple years extra to come to market, and they were so broken that it took them 2 years to get those cars right. Like, the A-bodies, they were supposed to die. The Celebrity was supposed to be replaced by the Lumina, and they were like, but the Celebrity sells better, and it's a better car. So we're going to keep that thing in production. They built that basic car until, what, like, 97, 98, when they stopped making the old Sierra?
Century.
I think it was the Century, too, yeah. So, whatever. Nobody cares anymore. We're just babbling. Everyone knows that the Ford Mustang is a successful car in regards to sales, but is it successful enough to guarantee its future survival as a rear-drive two-door coupe? Should all of the rumors about the next-gen Mustang's platform being used for a Lincoln sedan or four-door coupe, the next-gen Falcon, or some sort of crossover all prove to be false, can Ford sell enough Mustangs to justify the cost of a standalone platform? Could a future Mustang follow the Probe model and end up fusion-based?
God, I hope not.
They'll never do a front-drive Mustang. They learn about that.
I hope I'm dead before that happens.
Well, that could be tomorrow.
I know, right?
Careful.
He'll never have to see a front-wheel drive Mustang.
And I'd die a happy man knowing that I never saw a front-wheel drive Mustang.
That's not true, because you go to hell, and you know what they have in hell? They have front-wheel drive Mustangs.
The official car of hell is a Probe.
In more ways than one.
Yeah. Jesus. Yeah. I don't see them having a problem supporting a single rear drive platform with the Mustang, considering that's what they have now.
I could see them doing something more along the lines of what GM did, kind of find like a global platform and do different things in different areas.
Yeah, I'm surprised, and I know everybody else is too, that they don't bring over some of the Australian stuff to just sort of get some cost out of that. But I don't know what's in Ford's master plan. Clearly, it's more important to try to save Lincoln. I don't quite get it. I mean, especially because we've been clamoring for those cars, and I think maybe they're too big, maybe they're too heavy, maybe they're, you know, in terms of all the tooling costs to replicate that stuff in the U.S. would be too much, and, you know, to import the car is clearly going to make it too expensive. So I don't know. That's a question for the ages. And so we'll go to another question that came in from email, where Craig says he's thinking about purchasing a 2013 Jetta Sport Wagon TDI and was considering it for a long-term everyday driver close to 10 years. His concern is the reliability of VWs, and of course our opinion on VW seems to be that they're more of a lease car because of the reliability. And not ever having a VW before, should the reliability be a deal breaker?
All right. Well, let me tell you a little story. So, a good friend of mine, his mother was needing a new vehicle. She does a lot of highway driving. I told her buy the TDI Sport Wagon. It'll do exactly what you need. First 2 or 3 months, she loved it. Got great fuel economy out of it. And since then, it has been in and out of the dealer probably 6 or 7 times for just little crap, like nothing big. I think it had like a recall on the fuel system, the fuel rail. She got that taken care of. And then, like, the key wouldn't work. Like, it wouldn't open the doors or work in the ignition. So she had to have it flatbedded up to the dealer up there to have that taken care of. And just little niggling issues like that. You know, I can't say that it's representative of the entire cross-section of cars, but, you know, that's what Volkswagen sort of has a reputation for.
Yeah, we hear it a lot.
Yeah.
I don't know that I would let it be a deal breaker because they are so good to drive. And if you're going to keep it for a long time, you're going to get all the bugs worked out of it eventually. But it's going to be somewhat painful, I think. It could be somewhat painful, I should say. It's not like the VW diesels of yore. You know, they are a particular engine. They're particular about their fuel. They do need the maintenance and stuff. It's not just like sort of drive it and forget it, like the Rabbit diesels and the Golf diesels used to be. So I would still go and drive one and fall in love with it and could figure out how to make it mine so that it can stay in my driveway for the next 10 years.
I mean, I love the TDI Sport Wagon. I mean, that was certainly on the list of potentials when we bought our newest car, but they're expensive and we're broke, so there you go. That was the long and short of that.
Yeah, it will make you broker.
Yeah.
You might want to consider a used one so that it costs you a little less. I mean,
if you're worried about reliability, it's always the most reliable, I would think, to own it from brand new.
You see, I don't know.
You know exactly what goes into it.
I'm kind of split on that, right? Because, you know, the first sucker is going to be the idiot who has to do all the repairs and pay for it, and then they get frustrated and they get rid of it. And then you get to pick it up. As long as you carefully inspect it and you notice all the new parts on it, you get it for a pretty good deal. That's let me tell you, I haven't bought a lot of cars lately, so that's my blue sky thinking kicking in. So for a practical matter, yeah, just buy it new. I don't know what the alternative is, too. I mean, the TDI is one of those things where you just drive it and you hoon the crap out of it, and you still get 40 miles to the gallon in the city.
And I should probably say that, you know, I have a friend down here who bought a used Golf TDI and has had zero trouble out of it. They've put 30-some-odd thousand miles on it already, and no trouble whatsoever. So, you know, try your luck. I mean, they're really, really, like Dan says, they're really good cars to drive, and they're stupid efficient, and you don't feel like a prick for lugging around a giant battery pack or relying on an electric motor. Is that
your issue with hybrids? It makes you feel
it's not that sums up my argument, but it's not the only thing I have against hybrids, but we don't need to go into that. So
okay, all right, we should let's talk about performance cars, because someone, this will be the last email, but last week we were babbling about how the FRS BRZ, the Focus ST, and the Mustang might do on a track. And it turns out that Car and Driver has their lightning lap business, and they did just that. And the Focus ST brought up the rear at like 3 minutes and 21 seconds around, I think it's VIR. The BRZ was a few seconds faster. It was at 318. But the king of that sort of, I think that's LL1 was the class. That class was the Mustang V6, which I believe, Zach, you predict this.
Did I say that? I'm trying to give you props.
And I don't know how vehemently I argued this point to like maybe just start crap, because the BRZ handles really well. But then again, on a track, so does the Mustang, even the V6. And the V6 is like almost 100 more horsepower.
That's a lot of extra ponies.
So, the Mustang was 3 minutes and 12 seconds.
What was the Fiesta again? Or the Focus?
Focus ST was 321. Part of the surprise here is how sucky that car. I mean, we say sucky, like, within the class. It may be the bottom of the class, but that doesn't mean that it's by no means bad, or by any means bad, you know, around the track. I'm sure it was...
I would have liked to have seen how a GTI did around, because that was the only front-wheel drive car in the mix, right?
The Focus ST was, yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, I just, you know, there you go, Zach. You were right.
Boom. I'll take my one and leave.
And on that note...
Good night.
The Auto Pro Podcast is brought to you by TireRack.com, the leading online source for tires and so much more, including a large selection of winter tires, as well as aftermarket wheels, suspension, and brake upgrades, and those items that make it easier to see, like windshield wipers and replacement lighting. No matter what your vehicle, check them out at TireRack.com. And that is the Autoblog Podcast, I think, unless you have anything to add, guys.
I'm done.
Right. So, and nothing from Ross. So, all right, we'll see you next week. Thanks for listening.
See you guys.
Hit us up at podcast.autoblog.com and iTunes and all that stuff. So, there you go.
Have a good week.
We'll see you next week.